From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is KCRW's program of stories and original documentaries. It's part of KCRW's Independent Producer Project, a laboratory for radio producers, writers, and performers. And today on the program, we pay another visit to the world of legendary radio artist Joe Frank. For the last few months, he's been producing brand new programs for Unfictional. But for decades, Joe Frank has been making radio that defies easy description, blurring the line between fiction and reality. It's the experience of turning on the radio during a long car drive and dropping into the middle of something unsettling and disturbing and hilarious all at once. Joe Frank describes today's program as a sweeping philosophical inquiry into the nature of God, morality, love, human suffering, and restaurant tipping. That sounds about right. I think there might be a discussion of cheese along the way, too. It's Unfictional on KCRW.com and A Conversation by Joe Frank.
This is Joe Frank. On Wednesday, December 19th, I spoke on the phone with the Reverend Solomon Hicks to discuss our views on race, religion, morality, and other matters of importance in our culture. This program, called A Conversation, is intended for mature audiences only. The opinions expressed do not reflect those of this radio station or its affiliates, employees, their relatives, representatives, heirs, those who have liens on their property, or anyone else working in public radio, living or dead. It does not endorse and is not responsible and disassociates itself entirely from the following interview and remains at a distance, legally separated by a great shield, in order that whatever discomfort elicited cannot in any way cause harm to this radio station or its associates. And now, my conversation with the Reverend Solomon Hicks.
I don't mean to be combative from the start, but in a sermon that you gave a few years ago, you referred to the experience of the black people as a Holocaust. Now, Do you think that's an appropriate word, which means so much to the Jewish people?
Well, Holocaust is a word that is not in ownership of the Jew. The Jew doesn't own the word Holocaust. So it's applicable in so many ways. Here's a good example, Mr. Frank. If there was an ant colony in the backyard of my secondary home, And sometimes a rain will come, a harsh rain or a sunstorm, And wipe out those ants. And we're talking not one or two, but tens of hundreds of thousands. You see? To that ant, well, that's a Holocaust. If that ant could speak and say the language he spoke was English, so we were to have a sensible conversation with the king of the ants, he would rightly define that as a Holocaust. You wouldn't say to him, hey, how come you use that word when it means so much to the Jew?
You know that the term Holocaust is specifically identified with the genocide of the Jewish people in Eastern Europe and in Germany.
I know where the Holocaust took place, Mr. Franks, please.
But the word was never used.
That you know of. You haven't been able to be a fly on the wall in every conversation in every town in history?
Well, I may not have been, but...
How do you know that word hasn't been used before?
In modern parlance, the word Holocaust refers specifically to this tragedy that happened to the Jews, and it seems to me that since this word is so singularly important to the Jewish people, why could you not have chosen another word? For example, the affliction or the catastrophe.
Well, I would use all those words And I would call it a holocaust of affliction, perhaps, should I want to. But that doesn't roll off the tongue. Part of what my job is as a preacher is to articulate and succinculate, which means you have to be able to hear me, and those words should be pleasing to you in your oral sense. That's A-U-R-A-L, oral meaning of the ears, not oral with, you know.
I understand the difference between oral and oral.
Okay, well, I can't speak to all of your listeners. I don't know what they know and what they don't. I'm not at home when they play Scrabble, okay? So I'm making a presumption based on my not knowing everything that you do about your listenership. Now, to answer your question, that I, as a black man, can't use a word that is somehow, as I said before, the Jew has ownership of this word, is offensive to me. You know why?
Why?
Because they already own so much, and now they want a word. Now they want to say, oh, you can't use this word. That's our word. You should use the word affliction.
All right, let's move on to another question. You're familiar with the American folk opera, Porgy and Bess.
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, for those who are not familiar with it, it's about black life in a fishing village in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And this musical was first performed in 1935 with an entirely African-American cast. And this was during a period of great racism. And
I take offense to that. Okay, can we just stop?
I'm not finished yet. I haven't finished my point.
Well, I'm talking to a man, or listening to a man, who considers racism great. And I have to stop you at this point.
I didn't say great. I said terrible during a period of terrible racism.
You said a great period of racism.
I did not say that.
You said a period of great racism.
I did not.
You said great. Racism is great.
That is absolutely not true. The point that I'm trying to make is the music for that musical was composed by George Gershwin, who was a Jew. So this is my question. Has any African-American composer ever written a musical about a small Jewish village in Poland? I don't think so.
Well, your answer is incorrect. Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson wrote about a small Jewish village in Poland.
It was called Stetlinit. It was produced by Quincy Jones, and it was in between Thriller and Bad. So that's an answer to your question. So now you have been educated.
Well, I'm not familiar with this Michael Jackson piece of music.
I didn't say you were.
I know you didn't say that, but do you believe that the black people have suffered more than the Jews?
Well, I feel that great horrors have been visited upon both groups. But one thing was worse than the other. I think slavery is far worse.
The fact is that slavery has existed throughout the history of...
The Jews were slaves alongside the blacks thousands and thousands of years ago. That's how the triangles were built in Egypt, you know, and that was all slave labor, and the Jew worked next to the black, and then the Jew made a pact with God, and then God gave the Jew some entitlements going forward, so that they ended up owning, banks and media and things of that nature, Hollywood movies.
But you're suggesting that God is impotent, that God has no power, that he simply observes from above and...
Let me create an antithetical parable, a metaphorical hypothetical, if mm-hmm. you will. Let's say you have four children, Mr. Franks,
mm-hmm.
and two of them hate you for good reason. They left the picture, so don't worry about them. Now you got two more kids, mm-hmm. or two now to deal with. One of them is retarded, so they're in a bed in a special room. You love them, but not quite as much as the other one, who does love you and talks to you, converses with you, and you have power. You have four children. Two have abandoned you, don't ever want to hear from you because of some of your views, and they didn't take kindly to your communicative skills, let's say.
But where does your power exist over the one remaining child who does love you?
Where you can tell them to do a certain thing or teach them something. You try to instill in them the proper tools educationally.
But that doesn't suggest that that you have power over them. That simply means that you can try to direct them in a way that might improve them.
Well, sure, but you can. You can lock them up in a closet and beat them. But you don't. Or maybe you do. Maybe that's why one of the two left originally. I don't know. I don't know what the, I don't know what you did, what your situation is. Maybe you locked one of them up and then beat them. But my point is you have that power to do and to not do all these other things. But you, what you choose to do is give them education enough to say, here's where what you need to do to live your life properly.
Well, I'm afraid you're still not answering the question.
Answering the question.
Well, you don't even know what the question is.
Then I have every good reason not to answer it, don't I? You're talking circles, Mr. Frank.
No,
you come at me with these spears of poison questions.
Let me rephrase the question. If there is a ferry, and this ferry goes down, and hundreds of people drown, and men, women, and children, does God have power over that, or does God not have power?
Yes, he does.
So what you're saying is that God does good, and he does evil.
And he does also benign things, like sometimes he makes a balloon pop, you know, unfortunately. And
what do you say, unfortunately?
Well, because maybe somebody wanted that balloon, and they blew it up too much, and it scared them, and now they don't have a balloon, and they had a little tinkle, and now but they're not home, and they can't change it, they're not near a store. So it's not the worst thing in the world, but it's now you don't have a balloon, and you soiled your pants. See what I'm saying? That's God working in a benign, mysterious way. Because it doesn't hurt no one, but it's not pleasant. You wouldn't ask for that. You wouldn't wake up in the morning, Mr. Frank, and say, I think I'm going to have a balloon today, but I'm going to blow it up too much. It's going to pop in my face and scare me, and a little weed come out. There's a lot of things to think about, which is why I acquiesced to this conversation. Because as much as I don't care for your abrasive personality, I do find the conversation stimulating in a way, and I hope I educate you, too. And when we get off this phone, you think, well, there's something I didn't think about every day.
Do you have any idea how condescending you sound? I take offense to the way you're talking
now,
to me.
Now, wait a minute.
You're talking to me as if I know nothing, as if you're that more educated in the ways of the world.
Well, I'm a world traveler. Mr. Franks, I've been to the beach in Bangkok.
I think this is a ridiculous direction which we've gone in just now. I want to go back to the
more serious question. I think you're a ridiculous direction to go into.
Well, you're just trying to prod me, and if you wish to do that, well, then go on. But let me go on to another question, which is...
Well, you just told me to go on. Now you're going on.
Well, then you go on.
Then you go on. This is your interview you're conducting.
Let me ask you this. What is the difference, in your view, between good and evil? I mean, can good and evil be objectively determined, or are they simply a matter of one's perception?
Well, no. I think it has nothing to do with perspective and everything to do with just the moral code that we are to live by, that God has laid out for us.
But there are some people who have one moral code, and there are other people who have a different moral code.
Well, there's only one moral code. Read the Bible. That's the moral code. Do unto others as they would have do to you. The golden rule. That's from King Midas, said that in a New Testament, I believe. All right, I don't know which one it's from.
It doesn't really matter where it's from. But I want to pursue this question about... what's good and what's evil. Because in history, the ideology that conquers, the nation that conquers, is a nation that determines what is good and what is evil. If the Nazis had won World War II, history books would have been written with an entirely different take on the merits of fascism and democracy.
Well, that makes sense.
The question then is...
Because they won.
Yeah, but
well,
is there...
So they'd be right. I don't understand what your problem
is. Well, my problem is that means that there is no objective right and wrong, that you can't go to the Bible or anywhere to determine what is good and evil, because good and evil seem to be determined by whoever is in power at the time.
Well, I agree with you, which is a minor miracle in and of itself. I agree with you because the Bible is one of the most popular books. Outside of the Twilight series, that is the most popular book of all time. And that was written by a winner. God won. God beat the devil. Cast him out of heaven.
And where is the devil now?
Well, the devil is in several places at all times. He can see all. Mm-hmm. He's everywhere. His permanent residence is in hell, Hades. Mm-hmm.
Well, Hades is the Greek term for hell. I mean, not that that makes any difference whatsoever, but...
Well, then you just bring it up to make yourself look so educated, don't you?
Well,
you interrupt your own thought to tell me something about how smart you are.
Well, I'm simply saying that people don't use the term Hades.
I just did. I'm a people.
Well, yeah, that's true. No one is perfect. I mean, would you agree with that?
No one is perfect. I would agree with that, yes. I have that crocheted on a piece of art that hangs.
What does that piece of art look like?
Well, there's three owls on a tree branch, and then one owl is hanging upside down from the tree branch, the one at the very end. And then it says, nobody's perfect, and then perfect is misspelled with a K. And then at the bottom it says, Grandma, 79.
We do both good and evil, and I certainly have in my life, and I imagine that you have as well, and which leads me to the question.
Well, not true evil. I mean, I've done some things I don't... I'm not proud of.
Why don't you share some of them with us? Well, what are some of the things that
you're ashamed of? I used to. It was a bad habit. Put my gum under the bus seat when I was riding the bus. I would put my gum under there. That's not good for anybody, and that's a bad thing. I should have just waited, but I don't know what. I was young and impetuous. I overate at a soup plantation one time. So, yeah, I do some benign evil things, but nothing terrible.
Well, as you look back on your life over your entire history from childhood, are you suggesting you've never done something that you are really profoundly ashamed of?
Well, there was a hit and run. I was late coming back from church. And I was not paying full dutiful attention to the road. I was distracted.
By what?
I had received a phone call earlier about some children in a foster home who were saying terrible things about me and casting aspersions on my character. And I was coming home from church. I was getting ready to go to the airport to go to Bangkok. And I was not paying attention completely.
So you were distracted by...
So many things on my mind. My character was being assassinated, and I was thinking of this upcoming trip.
And what happened?
Well, I jumped the curb, and there was an ENT ambulance, and they were loading in a woman, elderly woman, who I like to think of as already expired, but perhaps she was in the process of expiring. I don't know for sure. And I hit her, and she went flying, but I believe she had passed already. So I took that as a reason to leave the scene, so which is what I did. And I'm not proud of it, but there it is. I might have struck a woman who was already dead.
What are you proud of?
Oh, so many things. I'm proud of reaching people. It's like my words that are invisible have formed a hand, a long arm. And at the end of that arm is a hand. And at the end of that hand is the most beautiful Q-tip with a mix of what is spun cotton and silk and Jersey tea all rolled into one. Metaphorical Q-tip, which then goes into every person in my congregation's ear and then cleans it out.
Cleans it out of what?
Cleans the gook, the bad words out of that person's ears and the bad thoughts, the impure thoughts. And then the Q-tip magically evaporates and then the words come flying through like a hose. Like I just got a big hose and squirted them all down. And then some of the words ended up on the T-shirts and in the pews. But the other words went right into the eardrum hole.
Mm-hmm.
And we get stuck.
And that's a good thing.
Oh, I think it's a very good thing. I always tip generously, unless it's one of those young, yuppie, hipster coffee house places where they demand a tip. You say, "Can I have a large coffee, please?" And then they point to the cups in the coffee station.
Mm-hmm.
And they want me to tip for that. No, thank you.
Because you don't think that they've done enough to warrant your
tipping.
They
haven't done anything. They did their job. God bless them. They're lucky they have a job. But now you want to tip on top of that just for pointing to a cup. You go get it. Go make it yourself.
Under what circumstances do you think it's appropriate to tip? Or don't you ever tip?
Oh, I tip quite generously. But often I don't. Because the server has not warranted the extra money. Don't forget the meaning of the word tip. It's the very top of something. So here's the bill you gave me,
mm-hmm.
and here's X amount of dollars or whatever, and now you want something at the very, very top of it. You just added to the top of money. So there's a pile of money, and now you want me to put more money at the top of that, mm-hmm. meaning the tip. Say I'm dining with a lady,
mm-hmm.
then that server pulls out the chair for her. But then the server does not pull out the chair for me. No tip. Now, say I go to the bathroom for 5 minutes, and it's been a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm in there for a reason that I want my date to know about. And then the server doesn't say anything mm-hmm. about why was you in the bathroom for so long. No tip.
I'm sorry, but what do you mean going to the bathroom for 5 minutes because you want your date to know something about you? Did you say that?
Just apply the deductive reasoning to it, Mr. Frank. If one is in the bathroom, the restroom, for a particularly long time, maybe it's because one's genitalia takes a long time to extract and then to reacquaint itself with the inside of your underpants. Do you get my meaning?
What do you hope to accomplish by doing this?
Well, I just try to plant the seed of curiosity, and then I let Mother Nature take over.
So you think a woman would be aroused or more interested in you if you did go to the bathroom and remained there for 5 minutes, and that she could draw the inference that you were...
Well, I hope that she infers it, but if she does not, that's why the waiter should say something. When I wink at them, and sometimes I have to sit down and go, boy, I was in the bathroom for an extra long time, wasn't I? And then I wink repeatedly, and hopefully they get the message.
Well, if you wink repeatedly, don't you think it's possible to be misunderstood and that somebody would just simply think that you have a tick?
Yeah, but I just came back from the restroom, so surely I would have seen the tick in there. I'm assuming there's mirrors in the bathroom, so I would have seen the tick is what I'm saying.
Have you ever been in love?
Oh, several times, Mr. Frank. I am in love every day. Mm-hmm. I love when I see a beautiful woman walking down the street, especially from behind, in that visual field, I often fall in love. My mother is perhaps one of the most important women that I love, not in a, you know, functional way with the penis, but with the heart. You know what else I love? Munster cheese. I wouldn't want to make love to it or have try to get the government to say, hey, why don't you legalize my love for Munster cheese, which I think is wrong. I love mounds. I don't like almond joy because I think that almond kind of mucks it up a bit, because I love the purity of coconut with chocolate.
You've been listening to A Conversation, an improvisation between Joe Frank and David Cross, recorded and mixed by Ray Guarna, edited in collaboration with Michael Story. And you can dig deep into the Joe Frank archives and hear his entire body of work at his website, joefrank.com.
Get a job, save your money, listen to change. Everybody knows umbrellas cause more in the rain. And all the news is bad. Is there any other kind? And everybody's talking at the same time. And everybody's talking at the same time.
I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional, part of KCRW's independent producer project. The editor is Jacob Conrad. The music supervisor is Dan Wilcox. Production assistance from Monica Scott. Thanks to the Annenberg Foundation, the Goldhirsch Foundation, and the Roth Family Foundation. You can find past episodes at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. You can like the show on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, @unfictional. You can podcast the show on iTunes. And if you do like the program, please tell your friends about it. Or even better, leave a nice review on iTunes. I'm Bob Carlson, and however you choose to listen, I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.com.